Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I share frameworks. I tell stories about the things that have worked, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way. And all because I genuinely believe the teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And today we're going to be talking about a key element of creativity, which is collaboration, and how we can create something called psychological safety. But before we get there, I just want to say, if you have not subscribed to my newsletter, I send it out every week. It has my podcast episodes, my sketch videos, all that kind of stuff. Go to spencereducation.com. And up at the very top, you will see a tab that says newsletter. Just click on the newsletter and you're good to go. Fill it out and you will be subscribed to my newsletter. Also, if you have not subscribed to my YouTube channel, you can go to spencervideos.com and subscribe there. It's a key element of how people find my channel. It's a key element of how videos kind of rise to the top. And so yeah, if you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, that would be great. So again, two ways to find me are through my newsletter and through my YouTube. And then also, if you're on Instagram, you can find me at Spencer Education. That's my handle. And I share a lot of little short carousels, really short videos, reels. Check it out. It is at Spencer Education. All right, let's go ahead and get started with this week's topic. And I'm gonna actually begin by talking about TV shows. And I know I might lose some people here, but just hear me out for a moment as I talk about television. When I was growing up, many of the most popular sitcoms had a similar arc for pretty much all of their popular characters. And here's what would happen. As the show progressed, they amplified their characters' idiosyncrasies and often their flaws with zero consequences. So what happened was that over time, these characters grew into caricatures. Steve Urkel became so over the top and nerdy that he lacked any kind of dimension. And although he might cry or feel some kind of pain, it was minimal and it seemed a little bit off-putting. Kramer grew so neurotic and edgy that he became merely a vehicle for shenanigans and god-awful physical comedy. This is often called the Flanders effect, or Flanderization, named after Ned Flanders of The Simpsons, who moves from friendly religious neighbor a few decades ago, probably what, 30 years ago, 40 years, I don't even know how long ago that was, into this like satire of all things religious fundamentalists do. And I saw this same phenomenon recently, with Ross and Joey on Friends, as my son was binge-watching every season over a matter of weeks. And so I share this because that is the norm. That's what we used to have. But then, somewhere in the mid-2000s, a new character arc emerged. And I first noticed it on Parks and Rec, where Tom learned to be more empathetic and less self-centered. Donna demonstrated depth that went beyond the treat-yourself Donna that we saw at the beginning. April grew empathetic without losing her emo edge. Leslie grew more well-rounded and more patient. Andy remained completely goofy, but he also grew responsible. And perhaps the greatest change occurred with Ron Swanson. In season one, I despised the characters in Parks and Rec. I would just watch the show basically because it came either before or after 30 Rock and I would put up with it. But then the characters began to change. And some of it is that the writing changed and some of it is that they swapped out a few characters. But what really happened is that they evolved. They were changing over time. Each character, through their dialogue and their actions, became essentially a better person. And they changed because of the community around them. Watch the last two seasons of Parks and Rec, And then compare that to what they did in the office with Dwight, Andy, or Kevin. It's a stark difference. It has me thinking about the TV shows that I love. Part of why I love Schitt's Creek is that I expected this cynical anti-hero story and instead fell in love with the characters. It's why I love Ted Lasso, as messy as that final season might have been, and it sounds like they're doing another season. I really thought that was the last one. It's why my all-time favorite show is probably The Good Place. You're not going to find another show where the characters change because of each other as much as The Good Place. But it's also why I connected so much with a much more realistic Somebody Somewhere. I realize that these shows all get this reputation for being unrealistic or overly idealistic. And that's probably fair. And yet, I actually think this is a realistic trajectory. Give people a community of support and trust, and they change over multiple years or seasons. I wonder if a part of why I love these TV shows so much is that I've seen this very same trajectory with former students. When I taught middle school, I witnessed how an empowered community could do meaningful projects and slowly have an impact on one another. I watched students come presenting a caricature at the beginning of the year. And over time, I'd seen nuance and complexity. And that was the beauty of a trust-based community. Even now as a professor, I get to watch pre-service teachers enter a program and grow as people because of the cohort model we use and because of the community they develop together. And I get to see that same change play out in classrooms all over Oregon. In other words, I love these so-called idealistic sitcoms because they remind me of a reality I get to witness on a regular basis. Communities centered on humility and empathy and curiosity ultimately lead to personal growth. But as we think about this idea of an empowered community where deep collaboration can exist, we need to think about something called psychological safety. But before we get there, I'm going to talk for just a moment about the importance of collaboration. In my latest book, The Depth Advantage, I mentioned collaboration as one of the top 8 competencies or deeper learning components that students will need as they navigate a changing world. If we think about the corporate ladder becoming a maze, our students will need to navigate the maze of complexity on a daily basis. They'll be solving really challenging problems that they cannot solve on their own. They will need to be self-directed, yes, and independent, but they'll also have to learn how to listen to one another. And we can think about it as the notion of interdependence, being both fully independent, but also learning how to depend on others. They'll need to learn how to listen with empathy and approach problems with humility. And that's because when we think about the future, especially a world so shaped by AI, the biggest problems aren't going to be solved with a singular genius. They will require collaboration. Now, we know that, right? But it's important to spell that out ahead of time, that collaboration is vital for our students as they enter the workforce. But I also think that there's a bigger long-term effect that goes outside of the classroom domain. We are living in the middle of a loneliness epidemic, and it's hitting harder than most people realize. Chronic loneliness can weaken the immune system, it can increase inflammation, raise the risk of heart disease, and it doesn't just hurt emotionally. It's literally chipping away at the physical and mental well-being in these quiet ways. In a world packed full of virtual distractions, we can easily numb ourselves with these instant dopamine hits. But there's a lingering emptiness when we lack connection with others. So, yeah, collaboration is vital for the future workforce. But more importantly, it's vital for life, for community, for democracy. And yet, when I talk to teachers about collaboration, I hear so many different educators describing the challenges of basic group work, much less deep collaboration. Students are struggling to work together. And this has been something we've been seeing for the last 5-6 years. It's certainly something we saw coming out of COVID. It's certainly something that we've seen with the rise of social media. But we see it. Students are arguing constantly. They turn any shared work into individual work. They seem to struggle with sharing ideas or getting critical feedback. And note that this isn't all students by any means. Many groups function really well. However, so many students seem to struggle right now with collaboration. Now, we can point to things like technology, parenting styles, hyper-structured activities, a lack of play at a younger age. Those are all important factors, and we need to address them from a systems perspective. But we can't fix all of those things. What we can do is design collaborative learning in a way that leads to deeper mastery, but also deeper connection. And that begins with something called psychological safety. So if you think about this idea of psychological safety, I want you to just imagine for a moment, just think about the favorite teams that you've ever been a part of. Maybe it was in theater or in a band. Maybe it was in a sport that you did. Maybe it was an academic club like mock trial or journalism, yearbook, the math team. You get the idea. Whatever it was, these groups were spaces of deep collaboration where members worked interdependently. A space where you had a voice, but you actively listened as well. It was a trusted community, right? But you've also probably had times where you've been on dysfunctional teams. These are spaces of unresolved conflict, cold indifference. In these moments, all you wanted to do was just take off and leave. And it's easy to look at the differences between the functional, thriving teams and the dysfunctional teams and assume that it's just the makeup of the team itself. And sometimes that's the case. Maybe it's the wrong mix of personalities or skills or strengths, or perhaps it's an issue of communication. Sometimes the issue is simply personal or even structural. But often the real issue is something much deeper. It's ever present, but it feels intangible. There's a sense that you either belong or you don't belong. And this vibe says, please share and contribute, or you better keep your distance. It's a message that we internalize, that we feel. And it's powerful. In these moments, this intangible element, it's something called psychological safety. I don't know why I had such a hard time saying that. Psychological safety. This is the shared belief that within a group, it's safe to take risks, ask questions, make mistakes, share ideas, and that you can do all of those things without a fear of rejection or punishment. Note that psychological safety is not always comfortable. It's going to include challenges. It's going to have conflict. And it shouldn't be confused with things like safe spaces that have trigger warnings. That's not what this is all about. It's also not a thing of like an overtly positive culture, which is sometimes called toxic positivity. There will be unpleasant emotions in a psychologically safe space. What psychological safety is it's a genuine belief that you have the freedom and you have the place where you can be yourself, you can contribute, you can challenge ideas. There's a great book by Timothy Clark, and he describes what he calls the 4 stages of psychological safety. I love this particular book. It's one of my favorites. Actually, my good friend, and he's a PBL expert and a phenomenal principal, Ross Cooper, recommended it to me. The idea is that we experience these phases or stages of psychological safety, that it's not immediate. It's not a light switch that you can flip on and off. It's more like a ladder that students climb step by step, with each stage building on the last one. So maybe not a ladder, maybe a staircase. And when students feel psychologically safe, they're more likely to engage, to take risks, to stay resilient through all of the hard stuff you ask them to do. So it has this component of leading to deeper collaboration, but also leading to deeper learning. So let's think about this idea of psychological safety. At the far end, you have something called exclusion. This is a complete lack of psychological safety. This is where a student might feel that they don't have a space within a group or a team. They might feel ignored or unseen. I've noticed that this is especially true for students who are socially awkward, like I was as a kid, or even just really introverted, also me as a kid. But it can be true of students who are learning a language for the first time. I've seen that. Or who are new to a culture. I noticed this happens with some of the students who are neurodivergent and they're trying to figure out what their space is within a group. In some cases, students might be deliberately silenced. This can happen when there's unhealthy power dynamics. And I've seen this with certain small groups where like a few kids are already close friends and they seem to hold the power over others. But it could be that they're just simply stronger academically and they use that as a sense of power as well. For many students, exclusion is a quiet message that they just don't belong. And I've seen this with students who want to be a part of the group, but they walk away the moment that they sense like, I don't belong here. And this is often an issue of fear and insecurity. So sometimes you have students who actually want to collaborate, but they feel unable to do so. And that's exclusion. And sometimes that will happen to you as a teacher. That will happen in your class even when you have done everything possible to create inclusion. There are just things that are sometimes outside of your control, but we can also structure certain things into it to build this first step of inclusion safety. And this is the basic sense of belonging that we all need. Students feel seen and valued for who they are. There's no prerequisites, no performance required. It's just what happens when you greet students by name at the door and ask them about their weekend, or when you stop by one of their extracurricular activities. Students feel this inclusion safety when they see their culture or language or identity showing up in classroom materials. And different types of students need it in different ways. For English language learners, this often starts with small intentional moves. It might be sentence stems and visuals that make it easier to participate in the class. It might be a buddy system that helps with translations. Sometimes it means providing think time before speaking or allowing them to write instead of talk. It can be as simple as learning to pronounce their names correctly or encouraging them to share a story from their home country. And it's all about creating a space where language isn't a barrier to connection. It's a bridge. For students receiving special ed services, this inclusion safety might come through things like clarity and consistency and kindness, clear expectations, predictable routines, a structure that they can trust. It's offering a quiet spot when the noise feels like too much. It often means giving students choices in how to participate while still holding them to high academic standards. It's about looking beyond the label and seeing the whole child, and in many cases, recognizing some of their hidden gifts. Speaking of gifts, for gifted learners, inclusion safety might include giving them the permission to be different. Another thing that I had experienced as a kid, right? Introverted, awkward, and gifted. Here they realize it's safe to geek out on obscure topics. It's reminding them that intensity isn't something to hide, it's something to celebrate. And it's letting them engage in things like fluid reasoning. There are a lot of ways we can build this inclusion safety. One of my favorite ways is actually through a choice-based show-and-tell activity. They can choose an item that represents their culture, an item that represents a powerful memory, or an item that represents something that they geek out on. And they get to share how much they want to share. with the rest of the class. So that's step one. That's the idea of inclusion safety. As that develops in your classroom culture, you know, there are other pieces that you can do. You might do team building activities, small group roles, normalizing silence during parts of the learning, doing check-ins to see how they're doing. But they're going to naturally move into the next stage of learner safety. So once they feel a sense of belonging, you want them to experience this sense of the freedom and the permission to ask questions, to try, to fail, and to grow without fear of ridicule. And in this stage, what they're experiencing is something called learner safety. Here, students feel that freedom to wrestle with ideas without looking dumb. We see this with a student who raises their hand to say, "I don't get it," and nobody laughs at them, right? This kind of safety allows students to focus on the learning rather than having to protect their images. They're more likely to ask follow-up questions in a Socratic seminar or offer an imperfect answer during a math talk. They see struggle not as a sign of weakness, but as a natural part of the learning process. So how do we build learner safety? We start by normalizing struggles. Use language that celebrates effort and revision, saying things like, "This is part of where it gets tricky," or "If you're confused, you're probably right where you should be." You can teach them about the notion of a growth mindset, or you could do something like epic fails, where everyone in the class says, you know, uses a sentence stem, "My epic fail was blank, what I learned was blank, next time I will blank." And then they celebrate their epic fail with a partner, and then you randomly call on one student who shares it to the whole group, and they all cheer, and it just becomes a classroom ritual. Another thing that you can do is create sentence stems that invite uncertainty. So things like, "I'm wondering if," or "could it be that?" Instead of just calling on the first hand, you provide wait time. All of these things help build learner safety. The next stage, though, is contributor safety. So as confidence builds, you might feel empowered to use your skills and ideas to make a meaningful difference. And you might notice that you have a distinct role that others will respect. And this is contributor safety. I don't know why that's so hard for me to say. This is where students lead discussions, they take charge in projects, they bring their creativity to the table, and it's not just about participating, it's about shaping the learning experience. They don't just take feedback, they give it. They're not just following the plan, they're helping to build it. So how do we get there? One of the best ways is to start with Kagan structures. I already mentioned them a little bit, but rally robin, stand up, hand up, pair up, think, pair, share, timed, pair, share. You could also use the visible thinking strategies from Harvard's Project Zero, and those are a great way to build interdependence into the sort of shared brainstorm and shared processing and things like that that are a part of the visible thinking routines. So those are all ways that you can build contributor safety. You can also create group roles. That is one of the best ways to develop a contributor safety. You can do group warm-ups that focus on curiosity. All of those types of things help build contributor safety. I'll also say that it makes a difference here in terms of how the group is being graded. One of the best ways to allow students to feel like they can contribute in a group is to avoid giving out a group grade. You know, making sure that you're grading students individually will help create or develop this sense of the contributor safety that you want within your groups. But as they develop that, eventually we want them to get to the highest level, which is stage four, challenger safety. Here, when you experience challenger safety, you can question norms, challenge the status quo, and push for change. With this sense of safety, there's an underlying trust that you can disagree without being shut down. You won't be viewed as negative or mean. And this is the student who feels totally fine saying, what if we did it a different way? Or I'm not sure I agree with that article, or could we consider blank instead? When the classroom culture is strong, that challenger safety can spark deeper thinking instead of defensiveness. And I've found that it can help to teach students the distinction between critical feedback and being mean. So if you want to check it out, I have a feedback and trust grid that I use with students where they can see that if there's high trust, that that leads to affirmation and critical feedback versus low trust where you have manipulation and hating. And there's a whole grid where it's high to low from trust and then high to low from, you know, the type of feedback you're getting, or negative to positive. So, you know, positive feedback, low trust is manipulation. That's flattery. Low, you know, trust and negative feedback is hating. And, you know, we know from Taylor Swift that the haters are going to hate. And then critical feedback is when you have high trust but negative feedback. And then affirmation is when you have high trust and you have positive feedback. You can build it into the structures that you use, like the 20-minute peer feedback system. There's a whole download connected to that. And the goal is that you design moments where you're asking students to be critical and to challenge ideas in a safe way. This fourth stage is probably the hardest to reach, and that's okay. It can feel vulnerable to give and receive that kind of critical feedback. The fear of being judged, rejected, or simply being wrong can be a significant barrier. Yet without the sense of psychological safety, innovation stalls. Collaboration becomes shallow. Students might go along with the first idea that sounds acceptable rather than pushing for something better. Building challenger safety takes intentional effort and consistent modeling from teachers. It means showing students that disagreement can be respectful and productive, and that making mistakes is a part of the learning process. But I also want to point this out. We have a whole year to reach this level of psychological safety. It's often a slow evolution rather than something that'll happen overnight. And it requires mutual trust. Clark's stages of psychological safety remind us that risk-taking and resilience don't just happen out of nowhere. They grow in safe spaces where students feel included and encouraged and empowered and trusted to speak up. As educators, we've seen examples of each of these stages of psychological safety. You've watched in amazement as teams generate creative ideas and offer meaningful feedback and create something together that they never would have created on their own. And in these moments, you realize that your students have moved beyond shallow cooperation and into deeper collaboration because of your intentionality in designing for psychological safety. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcast or on Spotify, Amazon, wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, whatever podcast player that is. And then also, if you have not subscribed to my podcast, just click the little subscribe button and it'll be there on a regular basis. You'll get all my new episodes. And then finally, one of the best ways to get the word out is just to tell a friend, tell a colleague about this podcast if you enjoy listening to it. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.